Now, that's the scary bit. Whoops! That's not quite the amount I expected to spend this month. But the good news is, I've only got a minimum repayment of £570, £87. So something's gone on. What's gone on? Well, I did it again. But how did I do it this time? Well, I've come back from the beach. I'm John Craddock, and I've just really enjoyed my time sitting on the beach, enjoying everything at your expense. But I would never admit to doing it. So if I had to talk about it, it was how could I have done it? And I actually ended up stealing your password. So what I want to do is look at, for the next 45 minutes, and these sessions are very short in time, but we'll squeeze what we can into 45 minutes, I want to look at the problems of passwords, mitigations, and how we might look at the future as well. So first of all, if we look at the proliferation of passwords, we've just got so many services and websites we want to access that we all have now many, many passwords. So, confession time. How many of you use the same password on more than one website? Actually, that's amazing. It's the statistic is 45% of users are actually doing that. And that is potentially really, really dangerous. And you'll understand why as we go through the session. So, it's really all about trust. And if you think about trust, is we could share our passwords with everyone if we trusted them. And if you look at the early days of sort of computer passwords, they didn't really exist. What we wanted to do is identify, it's time share. We just want to identify the user. And the password, well, there was a very, very minimal password, but it wasn't about security. It was just identifying time share for the users. But then people got very possessive about their time share, and they didn't have enough time share on the computer, so they would hack the minimal password and use somebody else's slot. But in the beginning, it was really, they weren't there for total security. If we look at the dictionary definition of trust, it says to believe that someone is good and honest and will not harm you, and that something is safe and reliable. So the safe and reliable would apply to our devices we're using. I mean, if we could say someone was good and honest, we could trust them with our password, because they're not going to take our money. They're not going to try and embarrass us by doing things on the web using our identity. We can trust them. Reality, of course, is can we always trust people? And what do you feel about that? How many people think you can always trust people? Goodness me, not a single hand. What about can you always trust a device? Oh dear, what an environment we work in. So the answer to that one was no as well. And then sometimes, though, we have to trust. And rather than thinking about trust, I think of it taking a leap of faith. We need to do something for our work, or we need to do something for ourselves personally. So maybe booking train tickets, or maybe using Amazon or something like that. We have to trust that this machine we're using is patched, and it does have the right anti-malware software on it, and we have to trust that we're not going to have our password stolen. So we do take this leap of faith because there's no other way of actually managing things. So if that trust, however, is broken, we're lost, potentially, especially for those people who are actually using the same password on multiple websites. So my four rules are, number one is, if I'm a system administrator, I own your machine. If I have unrestricted physical access to your machine, I own it. And if I get you to run a program with administrative rights or privileges, I own your machine. And therefore, I always think of it seeing hack attacks against machines when you're a system administrator or you have physical access to it is a little bit pointless, because once you have that type of access, you own it anyway. And that's just a fact of life. Right? So what we need to do is make sure that we keep the bad people off our machine, we don't run their code, and we don't let them be our system administrator. but we might not have that choice. So, you know, that your system administrator, you have to put faith in. That's the leap of faith. If I have a glancing acquaintance with your machine, be concerned. Let's have a look at that. So, I'm working with a colleague of mine, and this colleague of mine is going to leave his machine because he's going off for a cigarette break or a coffee break or some other kind of break, and he leaves me sitting there. And I'm thinking, well, why hasn't he locked his machine? And there's a sort of culture that some people are embarrassed to lock their machine when they're working with a colleague because it sort of shows you don't trust them, right? So they leave the machine open. And what you have to do is get that culture where you are not allowed to move away from your console unless your machine's locked. And so I'm left there. I'm not going to hack his machine because if I hacked his machine and put code on it or something like that, I would get into serious trouble. But, you know, while he's away getting his cup of coffee, what about if I actually sort of go and use Google Chrome to do a bit of web surfing? And let's have a look while we go. Let's have a look up here. And I'm going to Google Plus. And we'll try signing in. Let's see if he's got Chrome to save his credentials. Yes, he has. So I could now sign in as him. But again, I could be caught doing that, right? And therefore, I would get into trouble. I mean, this could be his Amazon account, whatever, where he's got automatic sign-in and Chrome is remembering. And by the way, I'm using Chrome, but it would equally apply to any browser. And actually, anyone use LastPass? Yeah, okay, LastPass injects it into the browser, and this what I'm going to show you, you can do with LastPass as well. So now, we've got that. So what I do is I hit the F12 key. And in hitting the F12 key, I bring up the sort of developer mode. And if we look up on the top of the console here, if I just zoom in on that, well, I'll try to zoom in on that. It's not playing. That's odd. Okay. Well, what I can do is I can actually inspect the element. So I can hit the sequence. I've then got over here to, I'm looking over here, and what it shows me is I've got type password. And type password is actually allowing me to hide what's actually typed in on the browser. If I simply just change that over here to type equals text, what it will do is it will immediately actually show the password. So there's the password for Ben. So Ben's password has now been lost. I just write it down or remember it, all right? And I walk away from his machine. I have his password, in this case, the Google Plus account, but it could have been to his Amazon account. So tonight, I'm going to buy all those goodies. So passwords should be dead, but the reality is they're not dead, and they're not going to be dead for a very long time because there's no other single technology that gives the combination of cost and convenience as passwords. There are emerging technologies that will get rid of the need for password. What I would always do, though, is complement a password with a multi-factor of some kind. But passwords are going to be around for a long time. So if we look at stealing passwords, we've got our user. Our first thing we can do is we can get the user to reveal the password. And the first one, of course, is the phishing attack. You know, you call up. Hello, IT department here. Very British IT department, by the way. They always trust a British IT department. Hello, yes, we're having problems with your account. We'd like to test it so it's not an inconvenience to you. Can we have your password? Oh, thank you. And do wish your wife a happy birthday on the 1st of July. Password happened to be Deirdre 0107. So that's one way of getting it, and it's amazing how well it works. The next way is coercion. Now, here you end up, you get a steel bar, and you go up to someone and say, give me your password. And they probably will do it, all right? The last one, there are more, and I will come back to more in a second. Next, we have our device. So we want to get malware on there. And email payload. And you have an email payload, and you'll be amazed. If you send people a zip file, and it says, see the dancing bunnies, right? Despite the fact that people have been educated not to open, you know, something like a zip or something like that, they will want to see the dancing bunnies. How many of you would see the dancing bunnies? Yeah, just a few hands. But I think it's a fact of not confessing. Next thing is a phishing attack. You know the type of email you get saying, oh, your PayPal account has been locked for suspicious activity. Please go and, you know, confirm your credentials. And, of course, off people go to actually do that. And, of course, they're not going to PayPal at all. They're going to something completely nasty, but they haven't actually checked where they're going off to. And then there's drive-by attacks via unpatched systems. So this means you just go to a web page, there's probably an iframe on the web page which compromises your browser. Why? Because your browser's unpatched. And then, of course, there's drive-by attacks via zero-day. And those are very, very difficult to prevent against. Zero-day, as in nobody's realized that that vulnerability exists yet, apart from the hacker. All right? Then we can sniff the network, so we can pull stuff off the network. We can attack by trying to guess your password at the login of the web service, and I'm going to come back on details on that. And then finally, we can steal the whole database, and that's a very common thing to do. Anyone heard of a company called Yahoo? So, what should I be worried about? You need to educate people against shoulder surfers. And it's incredible. You can go walk down the high street and, you know, the Starbucks cafe, and you can see people doing, you know, their emails, looking at their bank balances, and they're sitting on a really comfortable sofa in the window of the cafe with their back to the window. And as people walk by, you can actually see what they're doing. I'm always amazed that people don't pay any attention to that at all. The video cameras are their surveillance cameras. You can always have a quick check around. If the reality is, though, if someone wants to watch you, they can just use a camera that looks like a pin to actually pay, and your chances of detecting that are minimal. Listening devices, we can actually listen to keyboards these days and hear what keys are being pressed. And then there's spatial temporal dynamics. Does anyone do spatial temporal dynamics? It's like yoga, only different. The idea is you take your device and you back yourself into a corner and you check for cameras. You make sure no one's standing behind you. And then you check for mirrors and you're completely safe. And you start putting your password in or your PIN. And by watching your hand movement and also the speed of the movement, this is where the spatial temporal comes from, they can figure out what your password is. So that's another, you know, just backed into the corner and hiding may not work. So if they've got a camera on you, they can analyze that. And the bottom line is, however strong the password, you've lost if you don't protect yourself from this. So we go back to this. I've got various mitigations. So phishing attacks, in theory, we can fully mitigate by fully educating people. This is about education. Coercion, we can do some education and trying to get people not to put them in a position of being coerced. However, you know, the reality is, yes, you can be coerced. You can be forced to give up your password. Drive-by attacks for unpatched systems, obviously, we've got to make sure they're patched. Zero-day, there's probably nothing you can do about, so that's a fact of life. Network sniffing, again, there's an educational element against network sniffing, which I will come back on. I shall also come back on the educational thing about online attacks via password guessing, and then, of course, the stealing the database, and we need to talk about that in a little bit of detail. So, our data is very, very much in the hands of the service provider as to who we're going to. So however careful we are with our passwords, they might not be careful at all. So is their system fully patched? You know, can they end up with iframes that are downloadable on their website? So is it fully patched? Are they storing our usernames and passwords securely? That's another question. And we're not going to get answers to these. We just have to pose the question. And do they provide robust authentication and access control for our data? And while I was actually writing this slide deck, I went to a, I'm not going to expose them particularly, I went to a booking site for parking at Heathrow Airport. And when we did the booking, what it did, it prompts up this logon dialogue on the left-hand side, and what it's asking for is a username and password. So let's actually, I need to make sure I click in the middle of this thing. Let's actually run this, and you see I'm putting my username in, and actually, do you know what, I'd forgotten my password, and I just happened to just decide to click logon. And that was it. Everything came back. No password at all. All right. So username, my address, my phone number, registration number of my car, scroll down a bit, my credit card that I was using. They did actually only expose the last four digits of the credit card. And I thought, I don't like this. And I thought, how do I deal with it? Actually, it was remarkably difficult. It was remarkably difficult. When I did get through to someone that actually could deal with it, they fixed it in a few hours. They did take it very seriously. But, you know, it was like calling up. Who do you call up? Customer services and say, your website's rubbish. And I thought, actually, what all websites should have a button on, you know, you should have almost, you know, if you consider there's a security problem on this website, click here, you know, and there's an email where you can immediately send an email. And I think that should be sort of almost become a law, that there should be a fast way of reporting back if you find a vulnerability. But they have fixed it now. Thank goodness. Password storage is an interesting one. We need to know what your password is, right? If you come in and log in to us and we're, you know, we want to log you on, we've got to be able to check your password. So we can either do it as a one-to-one check. We can store your password in plain text. We could store your password in plain text, which is cryptographically secured. So if we've got the crypto key, we can, it's basically a reversible encryption. So we can reverse the encryption and we can check your password against a plain text version once we've done the reversible encryption. That we could do that. The other thing is we can use a non-reversible hash. And the non-reversible hash is basically I hash the password. I can't go back from that, but what I do is I get your password, I hash it with the same algorithm, and if the two hashes match, yes, you're okay. Or I can store it with a salted non-reversible hash. Problem with non-reversible hashes is if someone has a password which is password and somebody else has a password which is password, they're identical, right? The hash is identical for both of them. And there are things called rainbow tables. And the rainbow tables allow you to treat non-reversible hashes as almost as plain text passwords. So it's really quick, unless it's an extremely long and complex password, to almost instantaneously get all the passwords into plain text. And then there's the salted non-reversible, where we add a salt, a random salt, to go with the password. Of course, we've got to store the salt along with the hash, right? Because we've got to be able to get it back. And we do that. And then you steal the salt and you steal the hash, but there's no rainbow attack. So people have got to go through and basically compute every single time to actually verify it. And there's also various algorithms that can be used which slip the compute time needed. So it can take a long time to get non-reversible hashes which are salted. It can be a long time, but very small passwords will be quick. So if your database is stolen, should you worry? And the question is, you can ask yourself how the password is stored. Unlikely that you'll know. All right? How complex was your password? Well, only you know that, and I'm going to come back on how complex your password needs to be. And then how quickly were you notified of the theft? Well, you'll see some of the sort of thefts where you know, usernames and passwords are being published, the theft actually probably happened maybe 2 years earlier. So for a long time, potentially people have got your username and password. The big danger is, are you using the password on any other websites? Microsoft get hit with something like 10 million requests per day, where people are probing using usernames and passwords, right, which have been pulled off the dark web. So it's just a chance that they might get into an account. So this is in the Azure AD. And it's recently gone up to 50 million hits per day because of the availability now of that company I mentioned earlier and their 500 million password, username and password losses. So huge amount of additional probing going on. And that's what really people, when they're trying to get in, what they're doing is they're, you know, you lose your username and password because a provider gets compromised, and that will be probed against lots of other websites. And if you're using the same username and password on multiple sites, they'll get you. And there are other ways of doing getting you as well. So there's an interesting website, which is Have I Been Pwned? Or Have I Been Owned? And if we actually have, if we have a look at that, and I've got a cheat sheet here, so I've just pick up these things rather than having to type them. And we go off and have a look. I'm going to use Google Chrome again. Pop it in. And what it does, it has its top 10 breaches. It hasn't actually updated at the moment for Yahoo. But you see the phenomenal numbers involved. And then if we view all breaches, so we're going down, it goes on and on and on. And then it tells you a little bit about each breach. And so the for instance, the Ashley Madison, it says in here, in July 2015, the Infidelity website. It sounds interesting in website. So how many of you had username and password on that? Okay, but actually what's quite interesting here, and the problem is exacerbated by the fact that people use the same username on multiple sites, because these days it's traditional to use a password. So I can put in my username, which is also on my slide deck, so I'm not giving anything away. And I'm going to check if I've been pwned. And I have. And I was pwned twice with this. And if you have a, if we look at that, we can see I was pwned with Dropbox in 2012 and with LinkedIn in 2016. And LinkedIn, they actually just stored the passwords as SHA-1 hashes with no salting. Right? So instantaneously, with rainbow tables, they're going to pick the majority of passwords and get your passwords and then play them against everything they possibly can. So, you know, we need to be very, very strict with not using passwords across multiple sites, unless you don't care about those sites. So there's a thing that, you know, if you have a couple of email accounts that you use for signing up for newsletters so you're not spammed or something like that, well, does it matter if that gets compromised? You'll have to make that decision, right? But if you've got any sites with any sensitivity, you absolutely mustn't use the same password across those sites. How do we choose a password? Well, passwords should be strong enough to protect us against being guessed during online attacks. So this is coming in at the front end of the service provider. It's not about coming in and trying to stop you being compromised at the back end. So when choosing a password, don't think about this thing called entropy that's banded around, you know, and we use uppercase, lowercase, we use you know, punctuation and all the rest of it, and you come up with this hugely complicated password. Actually, but what you've done is come up with a hugely complicated password that everyone is using. All right? What it is, it's about guessability. That's the key. You need to think about guessability of the password when you're choosing it. And it's whatever password strength you choose, it may not protect you against an offline attack. So if someone steals the database, if they want your password badly enough, they'll get it. I mean, if you're running at about 18 to 20 characters in your password, you will probably survive it. That, of course, is if they haven't stored your password in plain text, in which case you won't survive anything. All right? Or they've stored it cryptographically, plain text, but cryptographically, so they can decrypt it, and they've lost the encryption key, because that's very common as well. Where do they store the encryption key? In the same location they store your database, and very quickly that goes. Or they've stored the thing as an unsalted hash. So what we really want to do is concentrate on your password just being used for a very simple guessing attack against the front end. So that's the sort of password strength we should be looking at. How do you research passwords? And that's a very interesting one. And a lot of people, when the early days of password research, use this thing called the Amazon Mechanical Turk. Anyone come across that? Okay, it's a service offered by Amazon where you can get human beings to do things for you. All right, so you could actually... you put it out for tender, and you say, you want me to, all you've got to do is come up, sign into my website, set a password, and we'll give you 50 cents, right? And then you come back, be asked to come back 3 weeks later for another 50 cents to change your password, or something along those lines. And this is the idea of using humans to do tasks. And I think somebody worked out if you become a Mechanical Turk on Amazon, you can earn at least $5 an hour if you work really hard at it. But have a look, it's quite interesting actually. So that was one way that people did it. So because users, very reluctant, if I said to you, what's your main password, what would you say? You don't have a main password, okay. So you don't have, they're all different. Which is your password for your Amazon? See, you won't give it to me. But what's really happened is really good is the hackers have come to the rescue, because now by publishing everything on dark site, it allows all of these usernames and passwords to be gathered and to do analysis on them. And this is what Microsoft now build in to the Azure platform. They're actually trawling this stuff on the dark, and they can say, your account is at risk. Reason being, they found your username and password on a dark site, okay? So they can actually pick that data up. But what it does, it allows them to do analysis and come up with what is a good password. So Microsoft's password recommendations now, and it's a very interesting paper, it's not a complex paper, it points to much more complex research papers. But this gives the results, so lots of people can easily read it. Maintain 8-character password, maximum length, or as a minimum length, but really maximum length as well. Because what they found is if you enforce longer passwords, people just repeat their password. So they go password, password, all right? And it's very easy to guess. Eliminate character composition requirements. You know, we've always been told we need to use it, but what happens is there are favorite characters that people use, particularly around punctuation marks. So you might say, well, if you include all this range of punctuation marks, we might increase the key space. But the reality is people use the plink key or the exclamation mark or the dollar. All right, if you're not using those, well done. All right, there are others that are used as well. So the other one is eliminate mandatory periodic password resets. So all the things we've been told for years to do, the analysis is actually showing it doesn't help. Because if you analyze that, what happens is people choose the next password based on the previous, and they choose something really easy. So spring 2016, summer 2016, autumn 2016. Goodness me, it becomes extremely predictable. And then educate users not to reuse their passwords for non-related purposes. Enforce registration for multi-factor authentication. So this is where we register. So if you're not getting in and we need to say, you know, we do an alert on your account and say you've got to use another factor to get in. Make sure that those factors are up to date. We send you a security question. Make sure the security questions are up to date and they're not used on lots and lots of websites, because not only will they pull your passwords, username, and they'll also pull your security questions if they're used on websites. What phone number are we going to call if there's a problem? Make sure that's up to date. So what I want to do is just have a very quick look at dynamically banned passwords. And I'm going to, first of all, actually use Twitter. So let's go across to Twitter. And though we'll actually create a new Twitter account so we can use their password, well, sort of their password testing, if you like. So, and this is just an example. There are lots of websites equally as bad as Twitter, and way worse than Twitter as well. So it's not a reflection on Twitter in any way whatsoever. It's just an example I want to give. So Ben at techdays.nl is just the email address. And let's pull a password, and let's go and pull a password from over here. So let's try password. All right, very popular password. Believe it or not, it really is. Okay, please enter a stronger password, fair enough. Another extremely popular one is princess. And do they object to that? Yep, they object to that. Now, here's a random 8-character password. All right, very simple one, but it is random. And what they say is, oh, it's okay-ish, but only okay-ish. Let's try this one. Password 0. Drop that in. So you can see that those password meters are not necessarily particularly good. And what Microsoft are now doing is they're doing this dynamic bad password detection. And because they're trolling the dark sites, they know the most popular, you know, passwords. So last week, in Atlanta, Beyonce was the most popular password because she was in town with a concert. So, you know, it's those sort of things that happen. So what's your latest pop star? It becomes the password. What's your hottest, you know, football player? It becomes the password. So we need to be sort of very careful with that. The other thing is, this is absolutely vital, and this is where people are sometimes a little bit weak, is the alternative to guessing your password is just to ask for a password reset. Right, so how are passwords resets managed? Oh, I have a password reset. It goes to my, you know, Gmail account. All right. Oh, what's the password of my Gmail account? Well, I use that on this account, and this account, and this account, and this account. Before you know it, you're doing a password reset via a very, very weak account. So you've got to be very careful on that. And you've got to make sure that all of the reset management, all the reset, you know, email that you're going to, the phone number you're going to, whatever other method you use, you might have an authenticator of some kind, all of that is up to date and current and as secure as it possibly can be. Because in some ways, this is a lot simpler than trying to guess your password. In terms of remembering password, if it's too difficult, it may be written down. If there's too many, they may be written down. If the use of a password slows down access, right, it may actually be removed. And for 20 years, the Minuteman nuclear launch password was all zeros. Why? Because they might delay the launch of a missile if it was a complex password and somebody mucked it up. So much simpler to have it as all zeros. Something maybe we should be a little bit concerned about. So if we want to store a password, we could use, for instance, a password vault. And we could use the Azure Active Directory, which is very good. We log into the Azure Active Directory, and it does password vaulting to a whole bunch of applications by default. There's a whole lot of SaaS apps set up. So we can actually simply choose LinkedIn, we could choose a different one, etc. That's one possibility. LastPass is another possibility, which does local encryption of passwords. I'm not saying LastPass is the one to go for, but it's a very popular password vault that people use. Or you do DIY. You use a zip program that actually allows you to do proper encryption on the file, and you store it locally and look after it. And maybe you store it zipped, and you store it maybe on a pen drive, which is also has BitLocker to go on it, and you only access it when you need it. As soon as you've extracted the password from it, you close it. That's a possibility as well. But it's not terribly convenient. LastPass is very convenient. So you go to password, and what it will do is it will inject the password into your browser. But remember, it's an injection into the browser. Therefore, if you do that little thing of changing password to text, you will see it. Right? So in terms of the Azure Password Vault, let's just have a very, very quick look at that. And I just want to show it in action. So I'm going to go across to my Access Panel. Now, my Access Panel is where I get all of my apps in Azure. And I log in, and this is in my customized hub, which I log in through. So I'm going to go in as my user there. And what it will do is gain access to a number of apps. And I'm signing in to Azure AD. And now I have access to all of those apps without having to sign in again. So I'm just going to turn on preview there so we see it slightly differently. It's always exciting about Azure. Things change all the time. So we go to LinkedIn, and what it's doing is actually injecting the credentials into my browser from a secure vault in the Azure cloud. And there we are. We're logged in. So that's a possibility. And of course, what I can do is I can turn on multi-factor and all the rest of it to go with it as well. So I've got a single login to the Azure cloud, and then having done that, I can then go out and use the password vault. So we have a great password. Well, all we need is a password that we don't use on multiple sites, and it's going to prevent against online guessing attempts. We put a black sack over our head, and I did think of actually creating security blankets that people could buy. So, you know, you put it over your head and you hold the device here, and nobody can see you actually put your password in. So those little pin cameras are not going to get you. Spatial temporal won't get you, unless you have your arm outside the blanket and they can see the shoulder moving. So make sure it's a big enough blanket. And then, of course, we decide that we can trust the service provider, because if we can't, we give up. Right? But what about the traffic that's going between the site? So in terms of listening to traffic, if you're running HTTP, you're running in the clear. I can very simply listen in on your traffic. And if you're coming in through a wireless access point, no problem at all. I can see everything that's going along there. Now, what people hopefully do is enforce HTTPS, but we can do man-in-the-middle attacks. And we can do a man-in-the-middle attack where we sit between your browser and the service provider. And what we could do is we could pretend to be that service provider by having a spoof certificate here. All right? A spoof certificate, we could create it ourselves, self-sign, and you'll get a warning saying, you know, dodgy certificate, do you want to use it? How many users click yes because they want to get at the website? An awful lot, right? So that's a possibility. But do you know, if you go into your browser and you look, there's a number of trusted root authorities, but there's 18,000 organizations that can issue with a certificate that's trusted to root. All right, so 18,000 plus, actually, different organizations can issue a cert, and therefore you will accept that cert. So there's HSBC Bank over there, and here's the HSBC Bank as my, you know, as the man in the middle interception. Or I can coerce or I can hack a CA. And there's been many CAs that have been hacked over the years and actually created certificates which are chainable to the root CAs and therefore seen as valid certificates. Another alternative is you can come in with an HTTPS session and I redirect you to an HTTP session to me. I then do the HTTPS session to the bank. All right, so I'm now intercepting. So in your browser, right, you're actually running an HTTP session. I can intercept all of that, and I'm not presenting you a certificate or anything. And the user needs to be educated to be looking correctly to see that they have a proper SSL session. Mind you, what I can do is I can change the favicon to a lock, and then it appears at the beginning of the browser. So that's another possibility. So man-in-the-middle attacks are a real potential problem. There's ways of dealing with it. We need to educate our users to understand never, ever accept a certificate that is invalid, number one. Know what to look for in your browser to make sure that you actually have a secure SSL session. So you need to educate those your users to make sure they know what to look for. There are ways around this. There's HSTS, which is the HTTP Strict Transport Layer Security. And what that will do is it will actually, the server over there can tell the browser that you have to use HTTPS, right? The problem is that the first time you use this, it would be possible when the guy comes with HTTPS from the browser to the site over there, it would be possible to intercept it at that point, right? But you have to, that's the only point you can intercept it. Because once that browser has connected to the server and been told to use HTTPS, the browser will then remember that for that resource, I need to use HTTPS. Right? Another part that can be used is certificate pinning, which is the HPKP. It's a public key protocol here. And what we do is that site over there tells you what its public key is for its certificate. Right? Potentially very problematic, because if they need to change their certificate, right, then they've locked out everyone that expects that certificate, the original certificate, to be used. So when you declare it, what you have to do is you have to declare your current certificate and the next certificate you'll be using. When you declare it based on your public key. So you generate the public key. You actually generate the public-private key pair, right? But don't go and apply for the certificate. So you know what your next public key will be. So those are two methods that are working, and also educating app developers to follow the best practices. Okay, let's just have a very, very quick look at that. And what I want to do is just show you on Google. So I'm going to go here, and I'm going to look at the internals of Google. And what we can see if we look at here is we can see the hypertext strict transport security. And down there, we've got the ability to query a domain. So let's query portal.azure.com. And it comes up with not found. Okay, let's query Twitter. And it's found. And what we've actually got, so this is a static entry that's actually been statically preloaded. And not only does Twitter preload the fact that it wants to use HSTS, but it also preloads the private keys for the certificates it will use. And there's a preload list that can be used. I think IE and Edge only adopted it in 2015, but they do now use this. So I'm showing it in Chrome because we can see this in Chrome. That's what we've got there for Twitter already preloaded. But if I go across here now and go to portal.azure.com. Portal.azure.com actually uses HSTS, but it doesn't preload it. So as long as no one hacks your very first time that you go there, what will happen is it will now, your browser will do nothing more than use HTTPS. And down there, there's a dynamic STS observed, this option down here. And that's how long it tells you. It doesn't actually show you in this particular interface how long it actually saves it. That's actually epoch time there, and it tells you when you actually went to that portal for the first time. So now the browser is always going to use HTTPS, so we can't intercept. So the reality is we could get our HTTPS traffic hijacked. So we need an alternative to passwords, and this is Microsoft Passport. So we got Sam, who's got a PIN instead of a password. So we use a PIN instead of a password, much more secure, only four characters or four numbers. And you think, how can a PIN be better? Well, the PIN unlocks TPM, and you've got the TPM on your thing. And he's been to one resource, resource one, private key AA, public key BBB, right? They're stored. There's the resource. The restore says, ah, we've got John with a public key BBBB. So we've been there. So actually, I don't know why it doesn't say Sam. It should do, but never mind. John and Sam, the same person. Oh no, sorry, that's resource two. I'm confusing myself. So Sam has been to resource one. Sam now wants to go to resource two. So what actually happens is you enroll with resource two. So what happens is you get a private key, public key generated in your TPM. We enroll, and having enrolled, Sam is the user ID is in there, the public key is in there, and now what happens is we log in, we challenge. We sign the challenge and send the response. It's signed with the private key there, and it's actually validated with the public key. So during that registration process, we basically give the site our public key. Someone steals that database, it's useless to them. All right? Someone steals Sam's password or PIN, it's useless to them without access to the TPM. So we've got rid of passwords. It's supported currently in Azure AD. It will be supported in ADFS 2016 for on-premise AD in the very near future. Right? So now we can log in with no need for passwords. We got a TPM, password never crosses the wire. So next job is we use Azure AD, right, where we can synchronize all our users. We then go to a raft of applications, and provided we use federation to the applications, which means we're passing a signed token, there's no passwords involved at all, and if we use Hello into the front end, right, or Microsoft Passport, then as long as we're using the federation, there's no passwords anywhere, and you should feel a little bit more secure. So, thank you very much for your passwords in the past. I don't need them anymore. Thank you for coming to the session.